This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
As we look back at 4 years of Donald Trump's administration, you could point to the beautiful wall that didn't get built, the Affordable Care Act that didn't get replaced, or the promises of an infrastructure bill that dissipated like a summer mist. But there's no dispute that Donald Trump's presidency has been one of the most consequential of our times. In one term, he's managed to reshape our politics and our culture in the most profound ways. We're going to spend this hour looking at Trump's impact on the immigration system, the climate emergency, and the politics of race and identity.
On this October evening, and it is so beautiful, the First Lady and I welcome you to the White House to bear witness to history. In a few moments, we will proudly swear in the newest member of the United States Supreme
Court. But let's start with the courts.
My fellow Americans, even though we judges don't face elections, we still work for you. It is your Constitution that establishes the rule of law and the judicial independence that is so central to it. The oath that I have solemnly taken tonight means at its core that I will do my job without any fear or favor.
Trump has tipped the Supreme Court to a 6-3 conservative majority, with Mitch McConnell certainly sharing the credit for that. But just as important, Trump and McConnell have changed the ideological cast of our entire federal court system.
Trump has appointed the most Court of Appeals judges in a single term since President Carter. Trump has confirmed 53 Court of Appeals judges, whereas Obama had 55. And Obama served 2 terms, whereas Trump has only served 1 term.
Jeannie Sook Gerson is a contributing writer, and she's a professor at Harvard Law School.
Those judges are remarkably white and young, in their 40s, and the youngest judge even being in their 30s. And given that on the Court of Appeals, they will serve for, say, 50 years, 40 years, that's why people are talking about it as a transformation of the courts for a generation.
I have to ask, though, does that represent a failure of the Obama administration? The Obama administration started out with 60 Democratic senators. They were able to pass health care as a result in the first stage. What did Obama do wrong?
I think all presidents have priorities. There are always trade-offs. You have to make deals about what kinds of initiatives you can get through. And these kinds of log-rolling deals have to be made. And judges are one of the things that you have to trade off. Obama left about 105 judgeships unfilled at the end of his presidency. So in January 2017, when Trump came into office, there were 100 spots right there.
That sounds like a terrible mistake, I must say.
I think in retrospect it was, but I think if you were to talk to people who were right there in the White House about it,
they would say Mitch McConnell blocked them.
That's one thing, but I don't think it can only be laid at the feet of Mitch McConnell, because it really is also about how much you want to push, because the Obama administration definitely got some things done, even with Mitch McConnell there. It turned out that Mitch McConnell really did care about the courts, as did the Republican Party and the Federalist Society. They have been focused on the courts, and it's a priority for them. You know, and I trace this back to Obama's legal education. Just as a lawyer and as a law professor, there definitely has been in the past generation a kind of approach that possibly he was influenced by, which is, oh, the courts, we obsess about them. But really what's important is the executive branch. And what's really important is Congress. I do think that he possibly embodied this idea that the emphasis should not be on the courts.
Now, we've just had a third Supreme Court justice appointed by the Trump administration, a distinctly conservative justice. What will this mean for the court? And when was the last time the Supreme Court was this conservative?
Okay, so I have to just put my own cards on the table and say that I do not think that overnight we're going to see, say, Roe v. Wade just thrown out the window.
Why not?
Well, first of all, it's a big deal to say, here's a case, the name of which possibly every single American who knows anything about the Supreme Court or about law would be able to name. If you ask people on the street, what's one case you can name? Probably they would say Roe versus Wade. Well, it is not the kind of thing that a justice really wants for people to be able to say, oh, overnight, a case of that much cultural importance is just gone. If they want to do something about abortion, it will take decades. There will be an impact year to year because we will start seeing decisions that cut away at the abortion right. One state will, say, pass a law that makes it so that it's harder for a woman to get an abortion. But, you know, it'll be in the form of a restriction that sounds somewhat reasonable to some people. And the standard in the Supreme Court is this an undue burden? Now, an undue burden is a very malleable and very ambiguous term. The collective effect of that after a number of years, if this goes on, you know, without the Supreme Court personnel changing, will be significant restriction of abortion rights. But we are not in a situation where I'm thinking that one day I'm going to wake up in the next year and see that Roe versus Wade is gone and we don't have the federal constitutional right to an abortion.
Also related to the Supreme Court, there's a lot of talk about court packing.
Yes.
And all historians will remind us that that was the bridge too far for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What's the proper way to look at an attempt to so-called pack the court?
It is really a great thing to look back at the FDR presidency and his relationship with the Supreme Court, because there are a lot of lessons there for us in this era. So FDR got into office in the Great Depression, and Congress and the executive branches are, as he said, pulling in the same direction in trying to deal with the Great Depression by enacting all kinds of policies that are progressive. And what's happening is the Supreme Court, in case after case after case, is striking down acts of the legislature and saying, nope, unconstitutional. This is what is known as the famous Lochner era. And they're doing that by reference to the Due Process Clause, basically saying, actually, the Due Process Clause of the Constitution contains a right that is not enumerated, but we read into it a right to economic liberty, liberty of contract. And so when you make these progressive pieces of legislation, they affect the economic rights of the employers and of the employees. They have the right to say, we're going to work 60 hours a week. And so basically, Congress wants something, the president wants something, but they can't get it done because the Supreme Court keeps saying, oh, the Constitution doesn't allow you to do it. And so that is what led FDR to say, you know what, this is an untenable situation. Let's pack the court. Congress would add six justices to the Supreme Court. And he announces this plan right after he's reelected in 1936. And what did that lead to? We actually saw the Supreme Court adjust. They experienced the court packing plan of Roosevelt as a threat. And several Supreme Court justices, both conservative and liberal, spoke out against the court packing plan. And almost overnight in 1937, there ends the Lochner era. There ends the era of the Supreme Court striking down these cases based on the liberty of contract. And now, of course, we're in an era where we think of the liberty of contract as something that the court just made up, and it was illegitimate, and it was done by a Supreme Court that was conservative in order to prevent progressive legislation. From the conservative side, they look at the Lochner era with as much criticism as liberals do, but they think that the Roe versus Wade era was another version of the Lochner era. an era in which the Supreme Court got into its mind that there was a liberty that is not written out in the Constitution, namely the right of privacy, and that right of privacy contains the right to an abortion. Modern conservatives will see the Supreme Court striking down abortion restrictions as a kind of activism, just like we saw in the early part of the 20th century.
So what would you expect Joe Biden to do coming to office? He's facing a Supreme Court that's 6-3, possibly 5-4 in some cases, against him. Mm-hmm. Do you think he will act in a way that moves toward packing the Supreme Court?
I think what he's doing right now is the right thing. Even though in the past he has said, I'm not a fan of a court packing plan, he is now saying, I'm open enough to it that I want to study the issue further and I want to enlist some people who are constitutional scholars who are really expert in this. And of course, we do know that the court has been as small as 6 justices. It has been as large as 10 justices in our history. And so there's nothing written in stone that says 9 has to be the number. My suspicion is that he does not want to go there. But just like with FDR, this is a dialogue where the executive branch puts forward a certain openness, and then the other branches kind of adjust to that. This Supreme Court, I suspect, they do not want to see Congress mess with the number of justices on the court or the terms. So they now also understand that when they're looking at a case like the ACA case or the abortion cases, the voting rights or the environmental regulations, all of these kinds of issues, they know that they're being watched with an idea that the institution can change without their being able to control it. And Congress will be the one that has the power. And they will factor that in. Of course, they're not supposed to, because we have this illusion that lawyers sometimes display that they only look at the case, they're only deciding according to the law. Yes, that is true to some degree, but there are all kinds of social, political, and personal career incentives, and then also the larger, more noble incentives of wanting to protect the court and its reputation, its legitimacy, and its ability to do good. And there's no way those 9 justices think that it's going to be good for the country if the court is packed. And they will do what they can to prevent that from happening. And so people are alarmed that it will be a very radical shift to the right. It will be much more moderate than that. It will be much more gradual than that. The sky is kind of falling, but it's not going to fall all the way down.
You know, in the context of life lately, that counts as kind of reasonably decent news, the way you put it anyway. Jeannie Sukerson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeannie Sukerson is a contributing writer and a professor at Harvard Law School.